I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:34 p.m. on Monday, March 2nd. Present today are Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, myself, Co-Chair Josephson, and Representative Bynum. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lestufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will hear two presentations from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. The first will be its FY27 budget overview. Then we'll hear a presentation on disaster response and financing. And I suspect that's why DEC is here. With us today from the department to present its FY27 budget overview is Craig Christensen, Deputy Commissioner, Bob Earnessy, Director for the Division of Administrative Services. Gentlemen, please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation.
Well, good afternoon, committee. For the record, Craig Christensen, Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. With me, I have Mr. Bob Earnessy, our Administrative Services Director. In the audience, our Special Assistant Legislative Liaison, Angela LaFlemme. And then online, Mr. Brian Fisher, who is the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. This first presentation, Bob and I will be giving a short overview of the department, and then Bob will be talking about our budget requests. The second briefing, we've been asked to talk a little bit about the disaster process, and so Ms. LaFlemme and Mr. Fisher will be doing that. So, I'm happy to answer questions about the disaster in the first part, but since the second briefing is about the disaster process, just so if you have questions on the disaster, you might want to wait for that part of the presentation.
I think we're well advised, and we've been joined by Representative Jimmy. Mr. Earnessy, take it away.
For the record, Bob Earnessy, Admin Services Director for the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs.
Okay.
And for the record, Craig Christensen. So this slide shows the organization of our department. Major General Sachs is the Adjutant General. Alaska Aerospace is dotted line. They do not take any state funding. They have not since 2014. They administratively fall within our department, and Major General Sachs is on their board of directors. We also have the Alaska Wing Civil Air Patrol on our org chart, although they do not fall within our department. We have a very close relationship with them, and their leadership does attend our meetings.
Excuse me, Chair. I need to be excused just for a few. I'll be back.
You bet.
Thank you.
Rep. Allard has an event, and she'll return.
Within the dashed lines is the organized militia, which is made up of the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard, also the Alaska State Defense Force and the Alaska Naval Militia. I'll be hitting each of these separately in subsequent slides. And then our state divisions, Veterans Affairs, Military Youth Academy, Admin Services, Homeland Security Emergency Management, and the Air and Army Facilities Maintenance. So I'll briefly be going through our divisions. Most of you are familiar with the Alaska Military Youth Academy. It's a tuition-free, quasi-military structure. And we cater to 15.5 to 18-year-olds who are at risk of not graduating. We have a residential and a post-residential phase. The residential phase is about 5.5 months where they live on campus, which is located on J-Bear, and then the following 2 years, they're still followed up. We have two classes per year, and in the last two classes, we've graduated 219 cadets. Our State Office of Veterans Affairs connects our 70,000 veterans within Alaska to their benefits that they earned through service. Things like education benefits, helping them with their disability process through the VA, accessing medical care, VA home loans. The picture on the bottom, you might wonder why there's a picture of an empty field. Coming soon to Salcha will be the Veterans Cemetery. And so in the spring, we should be breaking ground in probably two construction seasons if everything goes good. So probably by the fall of 27, we will be open for business. So one thing that we remind the committee each year is that when, in order to open, we will need operating funds, which will be in the neighborhood of $1.2 million. We are not asking for that this year.
Deputy Commissioner, there's a question from Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Justin through the chair to Deputy Commissioner. Thanks for being here, guys. Question regarding the VSO program. How are we doing as far as these third parties that are getting our grants staffing our VSOs throughout the state through the chair?
Through the
D.C. Christians.
Yeah. So through the chair, Representative Stapp, if I understand your question, you're asking how are we doing with the staffing?
Of the VSO program. VSO program.
So we have eight in Anchorage. Well, these are positions. Eight positions in Anchorage, four in Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, two of them are in Wainwright, and two of them are at the Vet Center downtown. One in Kenai, two in Wasilla, one in Juneau, one in Kodiak, and one in Ketchikan. Craig. I think that currently the Juneau one may not be filled. I know that the Fairbanks ones, as of recently, are filled. If you need further information on that, I can get that for you.
Okay. Quick follow-up.
Yes, follow-up. Rep. Stapp.
I had not heard that all four are filled in Fairbanks, but I will follow up and get back with you, I guess. Thanks.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stapp. Last I checked into it was probably a month ago. So, those things change sometimes, that is possible, but they were filled.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair to the department. Can you clarify, you said Ketchikan and Craig for those positions. Can you clarify that is at Craig with service to Ketchikan, or is that an and?
Sure. Through the chair, for the record, Craig Christensen, Representative Bynum. I probably misspoke. So there's one position that position is located in Craig with, but also services the Ketchikan area.
Thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Please continue, D.C. Deputy Commissioner.
Homeland Security Emergency Management, that division is our disaster folks. They, coordinate the State Emergency Operations Center, which is located on Jay Baron, basement of the National Guard Armory. Other things that the division does, they run the public assistance and individual assistance programs. They provide multiple trainings across the state regarding to emergency management, many preparedness events and exercises. Alaska Army National Guard is approximately 1,700-ish members. Their main missions are the ballistic missile defense up in Greeley, aviation, and infantry. They also have many of the support, military, police, engineers, public affairs, medical.
Okay. Next. Question from Rep. Stafford, D.C. Christensen.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to D.C. Christensen. A couple questions regarding the Guard. How many of those forces are still out on deployment supporting missions in Poland and elsewhere? And second one is, do we expect any change in posture given this conflict Iran? Like the other day, I see NORTHCOM issued a change in kind of the security force apparatus for the bases in Alaska. I suspended the known partnership program and some other things. So I'm curious if there's going to be a change in the mission of the Guard regarding those things through the chair.
D.C. Okay. Christensen.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. First question. So the 80 members that were in Poland have returned. At any given day, we have the National Guard does have people deployed throughout the world. We'll have to, in order to get you exact numbers, I would have to get back with you on that. The second question, so as far as the worldwide events that are happening now, the Department of War has taken the position that they will be the only people that are really discussing it. So regarding increased security levels of bases. With something like this, I mean, I think we can all assume that that is something that will be happening.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay. So the Alaska Air National Guard, approximately 2,400 airmen. Their main missions, they have search and rescue, combat search and rescue, air defense, strategic airlift, and refueling.
Okay.
So I want to just highlight that the Alaska Air National Guard is very different than most National Guards. Most National Guards do not have these 24/7 missions that are very similar to what active duty would have. So we have the air refueling mission. So anytime there's the fighters have to scramble because the Chinese or the Russians are, coming towards our airspace, our refuelers also scramble with them. So, they're on alert and strategically very important. We have the strategic airlift, which is C-17's worldwide mission, the combat search and rescue. That is also a 24/7 mission. Just as an aside, the search and rescue mission, it's a combat mission. The Guard is a reserve of active duty forces, so we benefit with having them here because as a secondary thing which keeps their training up, they are able to do all the rescues across the state that you see them doing. But that's not the reason they're here. They're really here because of their wartime mission. Air defense and ground-based missile defense are all 24/7 missions.
Deputy Commissioner, we've been joined by Co-Chairman Shragi. Mm-hmm. Please continue on slide 9.
Alaska Naval Militia, about 50 members. They're all either Navy or Marine reservists. They they will integrate into the organized militia for things such as Halong or other disasters. Alaska State Defense Force, approximately 225 members across the state and approximately 25 detachments. They're all volunteers, and similarly, they will integrate into the organized militia for disasters. So for Halong, approximately 25% of the Alaska State Defense Force volunteered to be activated and were placed on state active duty. As far as the highlight slide, it's top left state emergency operations center. In 2025, 11 declared disasters and 123 incidents that did not raise to the level of a disaster. The middle top slide is an artist's rendition of the new Veteran Cemetery that will be built in Salsha. You can see a couple pictures there of some search and rescue. We had 270 missions rescuing 360 individuals. As far as refueling, we scrambled 102 alert scrambles to refuel the fighters. Bottom left, one of the big things that the department and the state and the local communities and nonprofits was the response to Halong. The National Guard supported 18 communities. 501 members were evacuated from the villages to Bethel. 659 were evacuated from Bethel to Anchorage. Now, that's what the National Guard evacuated. There were many other avenues of evacuation. I'm just talking about the National Guard's evacuations there. And then some of the things that National Guard members did was debris removal. They went around assessing houses using a certain platform that walked them through assessments to determine the amount of damage to a house. They did hundreds of those. They did some hasty repairs to homes that could be easily fixed before winter. They also, in some unfortunate instances, some caskets had raised from the ground from cemeteries, so they were able to bring those all into a safe place for a dignified reinterment in the spring. One other thing just that I want to highlight that I wanted to bring up is the sexual assault prevention and response for the Alaska National Guard. That office is the number one. The National Guard has, you know, when they run their metrics, is the number one in the United States out of all the National Guards.
Number one at what?
Sexual assault prevention and response.
Okay. All right. Slide 12.
For the record, Bob Ernesty, Admin Services Director for the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. I'd like to start by thanking the committee for the opportunity to come before you and present today. The intent of slide 12 is to show a high-level budget comparison between FY23 actuals and the FY27 governor's request. It's important to note that, for the most part, GF has stayed fairly consistent between, with one notable exception, and that is the difference between 24 and 25. Where additional UGF was needed due to multiple items within the DMVA component, most notably the return of the IT PCNs, increased VSO funding, and tuition assistance for the department.
Slide 13. Question from Rep. Galvin for the ASD.
Yes,
director.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I'm not able to read the purple at all. And I think it's a federal funding, and I would have expected there to be a large jump in federal funding with Halong, but I'm not sure. And if you could help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
ASD.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that is correct that the purple is federal funding. However, you would not see
down here at the bottom.
You would not see any federal funding for the disaster housed within our operating budget.
Okay.
That is specific to the DA.
Understood. Thank you, and I see it at the bottom as well. Thank you.
Looks like Rep. Staff has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Kutcher, Justin, through the chair. So I don't see anything here regarding the kind of federal funding state match we get for the servicing of our armories. It was kind of a topic we talked about last year. I haven't been able to overview all of your budget. I'm just curious if that those requests are in there this year, because I know they got deleted last year through the chair.
Mr. Ernesty.
Through the chair, Representative Staff, that would be within our capital budget.
Okay. Fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow-up. Rep. Staff.
This could also be a capital budget-related item. I'm just curious if there's any movement on what are we doing with Alcantara, either as far as training and stuff like that, through the chair.
D.C. Christensen.
So through the chair, Representative Staff, for the record, Craig Christensen. We are using Alcantara for training as just like we always have.
Follow-up.
Rep. Staff.
No plans to move infantry battalions to train out there? Because I know currently, and this might not be in your operational purview, but that's kind of always the request I hear from the folks there, because they like the training area through the chair.
So through the
DC
chair,
Christensen.
Representative Staff, I'll need to get back to you on that. I don't have the detail on those troops.
Okay. Thank you.
So we're on 13.
For the record, Bob Ernesty, Admin Services Director. The intent of this slide is just to show DMVA's comparison to the rest of the state as far as a percentage of state UGF. We are a very small percentage of the UGF for the in relation to the rest of the state, and we would like to say we are small but mighty. Slide 14 starts our budget request for this year, and it is important to note before I get into this slide that other than the UGF that is a ask within our budget related to all of the IT study, the department is requesting no additional UGF. All of the ones that I will be presenting to you today are additional federal receipt authority, and that's pretty much it. Slide 14 is requesting two additional program managers for public protection and infrastructure support. These positions are 100% federally reimbursed and would be there to build stronger ties between the military and the state of Alaska, as well as local communities, for readiness and infrastructure development across the state. One position would be located in Fairbanks, and one position would be located in Anchorage.
Question from Rep. Galvin for
yes, thank you.
Mr. Ernesty.
These two positions, it sounds like something that a former, actually a current representative might have had as part of a commission to help the agencies work together. Is that the intent, that this is now funding positions for that, or is it a whole separate initiative?
D.C. Christensen.
If it pleases the chair, I would like to ask Ms. LaFlemme to respond to the question.
Mr. Who?
Ms. Angela LaFlemme.
She just came back in.
She's here. Yes. Ms. LaFlemme.
Sorry, for the record, Angela LaFlemme, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Could you repeat the question as I was answering another question?
Sure. Through the chair, the question was for these two positions. My understanding was that there was a new commission, and I think actually probably Representative Stapp could speak to that new arrangement where they were trying to thread better the different military organizations so that they could work more in tandem together. And I'm wondering if this is funding that work to some degree. Is that the intention with this, or is this a different initiative?
Yeah, for the record, Angela LaFlemme, through the chair, Representative Galvin, these are two separate programs. The Alaska Military Affairs Commission was established by the legislature 2 years ago.
Right.
And they do have a statutorily some of the responsibility is working to have those discussions for economic development for military and community relations. These two positions would be funded specifically through a grant from the Office of Local Defense Community Cooperation, which is a program under the Office of Secretary of War that is focused on more specific projects that are related to our military installations. They have a large grant program called the Designated Critical Infrastructure Program, or DCIP. Of the 10 projects that were awarded last year, it is a competitive grant program. Of the 10 projects that were awarded last year, three were two Alaskan projects, and they would like to see those increase. And so these positions would really be working with stakeholders that support our military communities to identify projects, potentials for that, and also to help drive forward some of the projects that are available for military construction. They have separate grant funding that can help us be better prepared to compete for military construction funding at a federal level as well. So two separate things, if that helps answer
Thank
your question.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And through the chair, when I see build stronger ties between military and civilian communities, I thought, and it talks about streamlining communication and improved coordination. To me, that's what I thought that commission was, but I appreciate hearing a little more context that it's more related to military construction and installation. So perhaps that's where there's a separate set of work. So thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Ms. LaFlemme. We'll go to slide 15.
For the record, Bob Ernesty, Admin Services Director. Slide 15 is requesting two additional Environmental Program Specialist 3s within the department. These positions would be under the Master Cooperative Agreement that the state has with the National Guard, and specifically the Appendix on Environmental. These positions would include and be primarily for hazardous spill response and safe drinking water options.
What's the interplay between bullet 2, which has DEC written all over it, and your request? I mean, I understand that there can be cooperative agency work, but can you describe that?
Absolutely. Chair Josephson, our environmental section works very closely with DEC, and specifically the federal the National Guard gives us additional federal funding for these programs. However, they have to be housed under General Sachs for us to receive that funding.
Okay. Seems pretty straightforward. All right, let's go to slide 16.
Slide 16 is just a kind of a reminder for the committee on what the department is requesting as far as the Disaster Relief Fund is concerned. The Disaster Relief Fund is managed by the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. However, the funding is not under us. In FY26, the department has requested a supplemental request of $4 million in general funds. This is primarily for the Halong disaster. And in FY27, we are requesting additional $24 million in general funds with $9 million in federal receipts. It's important to note that the $9 million in federal receipts is just a placeholder that allows us to come before the legislature and ask on an individual basis when a disaster goes federal for federal receipt authority.
Okay. I hope I'm not alone in wanting to slow down here on slide 16. You said $4 million, but I think you meant $40 million on general fund. And we had a debate on the floor. I don't know. Hopefully you have better things to do than to watch us on the floor. I mean, I understand it's the most entertaining thing. But the debate was when these dollars needed to be paid. What is your department's position on that? The supplemental portion.
Chair Josephson, I'd like to reach out to a lifeline on that one and ask Director Fisher to address that.
Okay. Director Fisher, it's Rep. Josephson here in Juneau. Are you with us, sir?
Yes, sir. For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And I didn't have anything better to do, so I did watch the floor session.
Okay.
The supplemental request, like Director Ernesty said, related to primarily to fund costs incurred by Halong. Just a couple of quick examples. We had, and I think you saw some photos earlier, we had a pretty substantial evacuation operation that was conducted by the Alaska Air and Army National Guard and the Department of Public Safety. Those bills are essentially due this fiscal year. As of today, I owe the state owes approximately $7.5 or $8 million to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, for a portion of assistance that went to individuals and households. So far, FEMA has already expended approximately $35 million in federal funds. We have a cost share for a portion of that. We are also continuing to house survivors displaced from Southwest Alaska in Anchorage and in other areas, but primarily in Anchorage. Those costs, as we move folks from congregate shelters to hotels, we're running approximately $4 million a month from roughly the middle of November through today. We're moving folks as rapidly as we can out of hotels and into apartments, but all of that funding is a portion of the supplemental request for costs that we've incurred to date since the storm occurred in October.
And can a hotel, for example, wait until June 30th to be paid? Or do you have the funds to pay them now?
To the chair, for the record, Brian Fisher, no, those bills are due now.
And so do you have the funds to, it's still Rep. Josephson for the record, do you have the funds to pay them now, right now, as you said?
For the record, Brian Fisher, to the chair, we are paying our bills as they come in, but we will require this additional funding for the remainder of bills as they come towards us for the remainder of this fiscal year.
Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair to the gentleman just speaking with us. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name.
Fisher,
Director.
Yes, Brian Fisher, Director, Division.
Thank you, Director.
Sure.
Do we currently have an updated accounting for all the expenses that we have to date for these funds?
Director Fisher.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Bynum. That's a daily process that we are working through. There are still costs that will come in. We have most of the costs from the state agencies that we reimburse through the Disaster Relief Fund. But there are additional bills that continue to accrue as we're continuing to house and take care of folks that are displaced. There are still operations being conducted throughout the impact area. I think you've heard from other departments, DEC and Department of Transportation, about work that's still got ongoing. So those bills will continue to come in, on a monthly basis.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up. Rep Bynum for Director Fisher.
Thank you, through the Chair. So I understand that we're going to have continued expenses as they come in. I guess my question really is as of March 1, do we have a current accounting for all the monies that have been expended, and do you have an anticipation for what we may be seeing into the future? And if you have that available, is that something you'd be willing to share to the committee?
Through the Chair, Representative Bynum, we recently did submit a revised financing plan to the legislature that you all took action upon, both bodies did, through a Senate joint concurrent resolution. That's our current estimate. In our next presentation, we'll talk a little bit about the process of getting the actual bills established and what the funding sources will be. A large part of that has to do with our collaborative work with FEMA on getting approval for federal reimbursement for some of those costs as well. So it's just an ongoing, complicated process. We don't have hard estimates for what the life of this disaster is going to cost. We have to work through every single piece of the response and recovery on a case-by-case basis with our counterparts at FEMA.
Mr. Chair, I'll wait for the next presentation to continue asking these questions. That I appreciate the response. It's not really what I asked. I'm aware of the financing plan that was brought forward, but I'll wait till the next presentation. Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Rep.
Chair.
Rep. Galvin, then Jimmy.
Co-chair.
Rep. Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Director, it's difficult to understand since I think I heard you say that for the next few bills coming for hotels that you will – do you have a reserve fund right now to pay them, the hotels, firstly?
Director Fisher.
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, we currently have $20.5 million from the Disaster Relief Fund allocated to the Halong response. To date, that funding is sufficient for us to cover the bills that we have to date.
Thank you. And you, it sounded like you have one of your bills is $7.5 to $8 million for FEMA. Is that correct?
Director Fisher.
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, that's correct.
So that leaves you with $12 million roughly, and $4 million a month is going to housing only for Anchorage. Is that correct?
Director Fisher.
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, that was the forecasted estimates of the costs. Those costs for our hotels are dropping every single month as we move people out of the hotels and into a rental assistance program funded 100% by FEMA. This is all dynamic and in our accounting system. So, as I stated, we're sufficient right now in terms of cash flow, but the supplemental request that the governor submitted is our current projected needs for this response and for other open disasters.
Okay, and last question, follow up. Is funding in any way slowing down the work that's happening in terms of reparation work?
Through the Chair, Representative Gallivan, no, nothing is being slowed down. And we'll talk about this further in the next presentation, but all of the work that we do and other agencies and local jurisdictions do when a disaster is declared is all reimbursable. Mm-hmm. So the work continues, and then the reimbursements, bills are submitted and the reimbursement process occurs at that point. So there is no slowdown in any of the work at this time.
Thank you, Director Fisher. Thank you.
Rep. Jimmy for Director Fisher or any gentleman you wish.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And through the Chair, I believe my question will be to Director Fisher. Do you think this isn't going to be Alaska's most costly storm under your watch when all is said and done?
Director Fisher, most costly storm, question mark?
Through the Chair, Representative Jimmy, I think this, the recovery from this disaster is going to be years long in the making. So I'll be coordinating the response and recovery to this for as long as I am still in state service.
Follow-up. follow up?
Jimmy, follow up.
Thank you, Director Fisher, for saying that you'll be here as long as you can be with helping with the storm. But I have another question. Have we paid our bills from the previous storm, Murbach?
Rep, our Director Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, there are still bills coming in and costs being expenditures occurring for the response to the remnant of Typhoon Murbach from 2022. And we'll talk a little bit more about how that process works for permanent repair and reconstruction following a declared disaster in the next presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. Anything more from the Deputy Commissioner or his ASD?
To the chair, for the record, Craig Christensen. This ends our department overview and our budget overview. And so if we could, transition into the next presentation, which will discuss the disaster process.
All right. First, let's have, if you will, entertain a question from Rep. Bynum. Rep. Bynum for the D.C., Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I have two questions that I'm going to ask. One is specifically related to Veterans Service Officers, and then one will be related to specifically Alaska Defense Force. So the first question to Deputy Commissioner. Currently, right now, we earlier talked about the VSOs and where they're located. Last year, when we went through this process, I expressed my concern about our ability to provide VSO services to veterans throughout the state and a desire that I would like to see some level, additional level of service being provided. I was wondering if the department has taken a consideration of reviewing what the actual needs are of our veterans across the state and whether or not there would be an opportunity to put additional resources in a VSO program.
D.C. Christensen.
So through the chair, Representative Bynum, this is Craig Christensen for the record. So we have, through a grant, we fund four different organizations, which are veteran service organizations. Each of those organizations then will hire veteran service officers. So I would like to work more with your office to determine what the delta is where you feel that services are lacking. The grant applications are, you know, do expect a certain level of And so if we're lacking somewhere, I would like to know what that was.
Rep. Bynum for D.C.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd be happy to work with you as we move forward through the budgetary process to talk a little bit more about this program, how we do grants, and whether or not we should have a more sustained focus on making sure that we have veteran service officers available to our veterans statewide. I as an example, I know that when we look at Southeast Alaska, we have Juneau, and then we have Craig. I think our VSO that's over in Craig is a tremendous resource. Worked with them personally, and I think that they provide great services. However, I think that the scope of services that we're able to provide on a daily basis throughout Southeast Alaska, in, from my perspective, is not where it should be. And that probably is true for many other rural areas of the state. So look forward to having that conversation, and we'll get more involved in it. Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Jefferson, my second question?
Yes, second question. Representative Bynum for the Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you. And through the Chair, Deputy Commissioner. So last year we had quite a bit of conversation on this committee, and I think in the legislature as a whole, to talk about the Alaska Defense Force and what kind of services that provides. And it was ultimately the decision of the legislature that we weren't going to be putting the resources into that like many of us thought that we probably should. Then we had a disaster, a big disaster on the West Coast with Halong. And so I was wanting to get a better understanding from the department's perspective if we did have a robust Defense Force established and set up, if that would provide better response to our natural disasters. And then secondly, given the national and world climate that we're in, with a potential for call on U.S. service members and National Guard, does this put us at risk for not having those resources put in place in the state?
D.C. Christensen.
So through the chair, Representative Bynum, Craig Christensen for the record. So the Alaska State Defense Force currently are all volunteers. Off and on, in my time in this position over the last 8 years, they have been funded and they have not been funded. Obviously, funding is a good thing, in the absence of funding, they are still able to respond. During a disaster, when they're placed on state active duty, their funding comes out of the DRF, disaster relief fund. So their equipment, their state active duty is funded during a disaster. So what we're really talking about is, you know, around a disaster, preparing them, training, recruiting, expanding their, the locations that they're at. I think that, you know, obviously, you know, the more funding, the more robust they are. But however, we're in a budget-constrained climate right now, and so the department has decided not to ask for additional funding for the organized militia, the ASDF in particular. What was the second question?
Rep Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. Second question had to really do with looking forward and the global climate that we're in and the potential call on resources from our National Guard and our service members, and whether or not that would put us at potential risk for not having organized, well-trained preparatory for Defense Force.
D.C. Christensen.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, Craig Christensen for the record. So, yes, depending on how things occur and where they occur, a lot of the military forces, the active duty forces that are located in Alaska could potentially be moved forward to other areas, which would leave Alaska with less protection. There is a benefit for agencies like the State Defense Force. Now, the State Defense Force isn't going to be a military organization that's going to repel the invaders. But let's say you have the National Guard has, for the most part, deployed forward somewhere, and then we have a natural disaster. You know, we rely on the National Guard for that, and if they're not here, the State Defense Force fills that gap. They do that anyway. So yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Rep Stapp?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Justin, through the chair. I'll be super quick. I'll piggyback on Rep Bynum's question here. So just to clarify, in your opinion, I think we're interested in mitigating loss of life, limb, or property in the event of disasters. So in your opinion, the request we had for the Defense Force last year, if we had funded that as a legislature, would we have mitigated any potential threat to life, limb, or property loss in this disaster through the chair?
D.C. Christensen.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. That would be hard for me to extrapolate out. I would say, the ASDF was not the only organization to respond. There were plenty of other organizations to respond. I do not think that it would have changed life, limb, or what safety, whatever the other one was.
Property. Follow-up, yeah. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, follow-up.
And just to finish that line of thought off, is there any requests in this year's operating budget? We're not asking for a lot. Is there anything that you would like to maybe tell us that we can help hopefully consider that would mitigate a potential future loss from future disasters for life, limb, and property through the chair?
D.C. Christensen.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, Craig Christensen. The budget that we're requesting this year is bare bones and lean, and we aren't asking for an AGF, just federal authority. So, I wouldn't ask for anything else currently.
Okay, thank you.
Short question.
Very brief question, right behind me.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair to Deputy Commissioner. I understand that when you say that the budget you're offering is bare bones, one of the things, and I understand the desire to have the restraint given our limited financial condition. One of the things I think that is very helpful to us, though, as a committee and as a legislature, is to understand what the scoping need is in the state. And we may not be able to meet that need given the financial condition, but nothing in the documents that I'm being provided give us any kind of indication of what the actual need might be and the potential outcomes of not being able to meet those financial financial request if we had that funding available. So that would be something very helpful to have.
Okay. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. My question is, if there was a local disaster operations center in Southwest Alaska, would that have brought down the cost related to the disaster?
D.C. Christensen.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, could you rephrase the question?
So if there was a disaster relief center in Southwest Alaska, like say in our hub at Bethel, would that have, because you'd be able to detect and track the storm better, because apparently their weather balloon was down or something that was supposed to track it that wasn't working or there was no funding for it. Would you say if there was a disaster relief center that people could have been warned earlier or that would to help lower costs of the disaster, do you think that would have helped?
Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's make Representative Galvin's question the last one, then we're going to go briefly at ease and talk strictly disaster dollars, if that's okay.
Okay.
No, it's fine. No, I want you to ask your, please.
So the question really is, I think there used to be a lot of different facilities where in rural Alaska there were far more opportunities for National Guard and others. And it's really piggybacking on to what we heard from Nellie. I'm just wondering if that would have made sense, that that's where you would have gathered that information and then distributed it. Is that the way I'm reading this conversation? I just want to make sure I'm understanding what the two of you are talking about, frankly, because that to me is, I know Nome used to have it and Bethel and some of the rural areas I've traveled to, they said, oh yeah, we used to have National Guard there. And then please help me to understand that. Is that what you are referring to, is a location like that that would be considered National Disaster Office type situation, if this is
Rep.
appropriate?
Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Yes, an Emergency Operations Center.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think you've answered that in the affirmative. So what we're going to do is go at ease at 222 and change out for the disaster relief portion of the hearing. And just so folks know, here's who we have. They're not all going to testify, I think. We have the commissioner from DEC, Randy Bates, the deputy commissioner, Crystal Kinneman, the ASD from DEC, Megan Kohler. We have these two gentlemen. We have Dom Pannone from DOT, Catherine Keith from DOT, and, of course, Brian Fisher from DMVA. So we'll go at ease, and I don't know if we're changing out the slide deck. Yes, we're at ease at 2:23. Okay, we're back on record now at 2:24. We have Ledge Liaison Angela LaFlamme with us and Craig Christensen, Deputy Commissioner. The presentation notes that Mr. Fisher, the Director, Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management, is a presenter. But as I noted, all these fine folks are here if the question seems more appropriate. I'm told that our DEC Commissioner has to leave at 2:55, and I think that's more like 2:54. That's how I read that. So let's go ahead and get started. If you think you have a question that is DEC related, please call up the commissioner or his deputy commissioner. Please begin.
Great. Thank you. For the record, Angela LaFlamme, legislative liaison for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Thank you so much for having us this afternoon. We're asked to walk through a high-level overview of the disaster response and recovery process for Alaska. Just for your awareness, I don't plan on walking through any specific disaster during this. It really will be kind of a typical disaster response during this presentation, but we may refer to specific events throughout to provide additional context. If there are questions related to a specific disaster, we're obviously happy to answer those as we see fit. So, first slide, why DMVA? The Alaska Disaster Act in AS 2623 outlines the authorities, requirements, and definitions that govern disaster response in Alaska. The Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management is created in AS 2623040 and AS 2620025. And they are responsible for the coordination. They are designated as the coordination agency for disaster response in the state. Part of the division's responsibility is the creation and ongoing upkeep of the state's emergency plan. And you can find the current plan on our website at ready.alaska.gov. And we're going to go through some of the plan here to outline, answer some questions.
Okay, slide three.
The State Emergency Operations Plan provides a framework for coordination. It reflects an all-hazards approach to planning so that a similar concept of operations can be applied to a variety of different incidents that may happen. You can see on the right-hand side the annex list of the different types of response considerations, and those annexes provide additional direction and guidance for those specific types of emergencies. The procedures outlined in the plan represent a flexible and scalable approach to emergency management. The plan utilizes a series of assumptions that's all listed and is consistent with National Preparedness Framework, the National Response Framework, the National Disaster Recovery Framework, the National Incident Management System, Incident Command System, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Comprehensive Preparedness Guide. The state emergencies plan and response programs are modeled after these agency frameworks and guides to ensure Alaska is eligible for the maximum amount of reimbursement from the federal government should an incident become a federally declared disaster.
Slide four.
On the screen, you can see an example found in the emergency operations plan. It's a matrix that outlines the different types of functions across the top. And then on the left-hand side, you can see the organizations who support disasters. Within this matrix, it outlines the primary functional responsibilities based on statutory authorities, resources, capabilities, and expertise in those specific functional areas, as well as support agencies who also have resources, authorities, or expertise that would support. So the operations plans outline who a lead agency will be given the type of emergency that we have. So, for example, public health emergency, the Department of Health would be the lead agency supported by the State Emergency Operations Center for statewide coordination as requested. Wildfire would be DNR, DOF. Oil and hazardous substances would be DC, et cetera. There is four or five pages of this matrix, so you're not going to see every... I didn't list every department in the slide, but they are all listed within the emergency operations plan and what primary or supporting role they would play in a disaster.
Okay. Ms. LaFlamme, yes. There's a question from Rep. Galvin for you.
I think that she just answered it in that she told us that there's far more. My question was truly around weather. I happened to be in Austin when that giant, horrible flooding happened, and I know this similar situation, and there's been a lot of question about whether we're putting money in the prevention upstream to understand and have scientists able to say warning and then make sure that we have all of those communication pieces in place as well. So I'm trying to understand when we see, co-chair, when we see that incident occurs, well, incident, if you know that weather is occurring or will be occurring within the next hour or two, for example, I don't understand which agency it is in charge of that. So that's why I was asking. But then I could tell she was reading my mind, and I think trying to tell us that there's more to this list, and likely that would have been what I'm missing. But please correct me if I'm wrong, if you would.
Ms. LaFlamme.
Thank you, Angela LaFlamme, for the record. Through the chair, Representative Galvin. Yes, so we work closely with the National Weather Service. They have a liaison situated within the State Emergency Operations Center. So we do track weather, especially with pending weather events, and are able to work through other agencies who have authorities to put out alerts and things like that. So for like tsunami alerts, that would be through the Tsunami Center. Mm-hmm. Volcanoes, earthquakes, etc.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. LaFlamme, last year we saw some cuts to the federal agencies that have been responsible for weather monitoring in Alaska, both NOAA and the National Weather Service. Mm-hmm. Did DMVA see a reduction of data inputs from those agencies or delays? We heard a reference earlier to weather balloons. My understanding is that NOAA was not able to fly as many weather balloons as predictors of upcoming storms. Did DMVA see a reduction in the amount of data lifetime that we were able to have in preparation for disasters?
Thank you, Representative Hannon, through the chair. I actually would like to ask Brian Fisher to answer that question if he is online.
Director Fisher.
For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Through the chair, Representative Hannon. We have not seen a reduction in service. As a matter of fact, I'm happy to report that through some multi-year efforts of the National Weather Service, they are they're working on hiring, and they're going to be staffing essentially a full-time position, a human in the State Emergency Operations Center on a daily basis, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, our normal working hours. They're going to be rotating some trained meteorologists, weather forecasters to physically sit with us in person Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, regardless of what the weather situation is. So we have not seen a significant reduction in any of the services that the Weather Service provides us on any given basis. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right, slide 5.
The Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, or DHSEM, I'll refer to as the State Emergency Operations Center, is the SEOC, is located on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The SEOC is situated within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs underneath the leadership of Major General Torrence Sachs, the Adjutant General. This is very valuable in our state. Not all states are organized this way, that they have their National Guard and emergency management within the same department. And because the Guard's Joint Operations Center is located right next to the SEOC, and this provides Alaska with seamless response capabilities when required. The SEOC serves as the state's single point of contact for an integrated state disaster emergency response. We follow the National Incident Management System, Incident Command System, and we support our local, borough, and tribal agencies who are directing emergency operations. Our SEOC is available at all times through our operations staff, and all of our department liaisons, other state agency liaisons, and support agencies have seats in the State Emergency Operations Center. You can see from the pictures there. We have spaces for our departments, our volunteer organizations, our military partners, the Coast Guard are also in there. We have the National Weather Service. And we also have a place for FEMA liaison. So from the very beginning, we have a very coordinated process within the SEOC.
Okay. Slide six. And yes, Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Coach Josephson. My question is, are all our weather stations online and operating currently in Alaska?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Yeah, Representative Jimmy, through the chair. I don't have the I don't know that answer. If Director Fisher knows the answer, I'd ask him to chime in. Otherwise, we could get back with you.
Thank you. Just follow up offline. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Okay, slide six.
So you're going to see this slide several times throughout the presentation. That just helps illustrate what a quote-unquote typical process looks like for disaster response. Every incident may have a unique set of circumstances, but we're going to follow a similar pathway as shown. We start with something happening, and the local community is going to be the first responder. Typically, local officials will notify the State Emergency Operations Center, or sometimes we learn about things happening through your constituents, so we really appreciate that line of communication. Emergency response is best coordinated at the lowest level of government involved in the emergency. So when an incident occurs, the SEOC is notified, communicates with the local community incident commands or their emergency operations center or local officials during disaster emergencies, providing that centralized response coordination. And that local capacity is determined what's happening, how many people are affected, what infrastructure has been impacted, and if the situation exceeds the local community's ability to respond. Sometimes it's obvious in that those assessments happen very quickly, and like we saw in Typhoon Halong, and sometimes additional assessments needed before a determination can take place.
Ms. LaFlamme, is the 75% federal funds, is that the presumptive number, and how does one get from 75 to 90%?
Thank you, Chair Josephson. The minimum amount that FEMA would respond with is a 75-25 split, and you can request it either will meet a threshold of a certain amount that the disaster reaches. So, for example, with the 2018 Cook Inlet earthquake, because of the expenses related to that disaster, that met the threshold for a 90-10 split. Or it can be requested as a special exemption.
Okay. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Jefferson. My question is, what does the appeal process look like, and can you appeal it any number of times?
Ms. LaFlamme.
10 split.
Ms. LaFlamme.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, I think I will ask Director Fisher if there's a limit to the appeal process.
Director Fisher.
For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, through the chair, Representative Jimmy. So the appeal process for a federal disaster request, and not just for the record, the only individual who can authorize a waiver and an adjustment to that standard 75-25 non-federal share is the president himself or herself. In this last disaster, the governor had requested 100% funding for 90 days. The president denied that, and so subsequently the governor, upon that notification, submitted an appeal to that denial and asked for 90% federal, 10% state share for the first 90 days of the Halong disaster. According to the Stafford Act, that's the Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, the federal law that governs disasters, there is a one-time appeal for that non-federal share. I will also note there is one portion of federal disaster relief Under the individual assistance program called Other Needs Assistance, that is not waiverable by law. So I mentioned in previous testimony during this hearing that we have a bill due from FEMA, and that's for what's called Other Needs Assistance, and that portion of federal relief cannot be waived at all. So one time appeal. Over.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Jefferson. Well, I am hopeful, Director Fisher, that we can get the appeal to be successful. Would you say there's a timeline for the one-time appeal?
Director Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy. So the way all of our appeals work with FEMA is the state does have some timelines for that. So the governor had 30 days from the initial request that was denied to appeal that. The federal government and the president does not have a statutory timeline. I will say I'll be in D.C. next week. I'm hoping to meet with the FEMA leadership in D.C. to see where, check on the status of where the governor's appeal is, but there is no timeline on the federal side.
Okay, so there's no timeline. Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
My question was the timeline.
Okay. So we'll go to slide 7.
For the record, Angela LaFlamme. So I've sort of used a couple of different definitions here. I was saying an incident occurs and a disaster. So when does an incident that happens become a disaster? An incident must meet the definition of a disaster in AS 2623902. For consideration of a state disaster declaration. And you can see on the slide the high-level definition in statute. So the initial assessment that we do that happens through the State Emergency Operations Center provides information through the Adjutant General to the governor with a recommendation who the governor has the ultimate authority to declare a state disaster.
Okay. Slide 8.
Okay. So once a disaster declaration has been issued by the governor, state funding is authorized. That's typically when we start being able to use the disaster relief fund available to aid in response. When a state disaster is declared, but before a federal disaster declaration, the state funds 100% of costs related to response and recovery efforts in accordance with statutes and regulations. And I will make a note here. We have our state capacity, 100% state funds, and then we have the joint preliminary damage assessment. We've kind of talked about how that federal declaration process works, and I will go into it a little bit further. But sometimes this process, we have a really good relationship with our FEMA Region 10 folks. They are usually, depending on the level of the impact of a disaster, are tied into our State Emergency Operations Center when things are happening, and so this process can be really a quicker process. Okay. So when the governor declares a disaster under AS 2623020, the disaster proclamation governs the authorities and restrictions for the declaration. So declarations are limited to 30 days unless extended by the legislature. For funding, the declaration authorizes the governor to utilize existing state funding authorities up to $1 million per fiscal year per disaster declaration. The disaster relief funds the primary source of funding for grants and reimbursements for expenditures during a disaster, but AS 2623020 does authorize the governor to utilize existing state funding authorities. It's not exclusive to the disaster relief fund. The one thing I do want to note, I will go into our state assistance programs on the next slide. The disaster declaration covers the area of the impacted disaster and also if any of our state assistance programs are activated. The other note I wanted to have here is under AS 2623020G, which outlines other authorities the governor has under a state-declared disaster. Two of those that were important during the response to Typhoon Halong is the authority to suspend certain state permitting land use requirements to ensure response, repairs, and debris removal can move forward without delay. And it also allows him to suspend state fees associated with replacing necessary documentation, such as licenses and registrations, and also waives late fees for state-administered loan and payment programs for Alaskans impacted by the disaster.
Ms. LaFlem, question from Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair, Mrs. LaFlem. My question would be, what happens when you exceed the $1 million amount?
Ms. LaFlem.
Let me get my notes back here. So the governor, for the record, through the chair, Angela, through the record, through the chair, Representative Jimmy, in statute, the governor may expend up to $1 million of state funds to cope with a disaster if a disaster exceeds the $1 million. Statute outlines that if the legislature is in session, the legislature approves a financing plan to cope with the incident or disaster. If the legislature is not in session, the governor can either convene a special session of the legislature within 5 days after declaring the condition of disaster emergency and providing a financing plan to cope with the incident, or if the presiding officers of both the House of Representatives and the Senate agree that a special session should not be convened, they can advise the governor in writing and agree to his proposed financing plan.
Great. Go ahead.
Ms. LaFlem, I must say that when I learned about the limitations of authority under AS 2623, so we already have the most powerful governor model in the nation. It's well known, the veto override, et cetera. This is one where I think it's just so restricted that there should be reform that would be generous to the executive branch. Now, the governor took from a Village Safe Water Fund. I mean, he was public about it. But am I right about that? Or actually, that was for SNAP. That was not for this disaster. Is that right? I'm getting my disasters mixed up.
Chair Josephson, I do think that that was the $5 million for SNAP emergency declaration.
Yeah. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justison. Through the chair, thank you for being here. Really quick, so when we talked a little bit about when monies can be expended. I'm just, for this past disaster that we had, the governor made a declaration of an emergency here and intended to expend dollars. So my understanding is that initially the governor would have had a financing plan if he intended to spend more than $1 million initially. And then my understanding is that if the governor were to exceed what's in that financing plan, that he would also need to basically update that plan. In this particular case, how many financing plans were presented for approval or consideration, given that the legislature was not in session? I believe that under Section K2B, presiding officers basically said no special session was required. I'm not clear on when the initial financing plan was put in place and when additional financing plans would have been brought forward.
Ms. LaFlem.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Bynum. I don't know the exact number of financing plan amendments that were put forward prior to the January discussion with the resolution. I would have to get back with you on that number. Typically, when we send the initial notification for disaster declaration, that includes the $1 million financing plan, and that goes to the legislature per statute, and then those amendments go. So I can get back with you on how many there have been since then.
Follow-up. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you. So when we put a financing plan in place and it says, for example, we were going to expend $20 million, can those funds be expended outside of the declaration of emergency? So under current law, we have a limit of 30 days, unless if that declaration is extended by the legislature.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So the disaster declaration does not have to be extended for the financing plan to remain in place. So we don't always extend the disaster declaration. The authorities under a disaster declaration are specific to that 30-day period, which allow for some of those leniencies that I mentioned in statute. We don't always need to have those to continue to respond. So the extension of a declaration is not tied to expenditures for response and recovery.
One quick follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you. Through the chair. So if a disaster is technically only 30 days and then there is no extension, funds can still be expended beyond that if it's related to that disaster. Assuming that there needs to be a new financing plan put in place because additional funds need to be expended, do we believe that those funds being expended and having a new financing plan in place are authorized under law, given that a disaster wouldn't be extended by the legislature?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I'm not a lawyer, so I wouldn't opine on that specific, but in practice, that has been, we amend the financing plan with legislative concurrence to continue being able to expend specifically for a disaster and not have to extend the disaster specific disaster declaration.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. My question would be, did the department have any issues with the way the legislators authorized the governor's appropriation for the additional money that occurred via resolution?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, no, and we appreciate the timely action on that.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to slide 10. Rep Stamp for the team here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Ms. LaFlamme. I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but I'm curious if anyone has ever brought a legal challenge to the kind of appropriation process regarding the way we do disaster relief in the state. Because, you know, to me, I kind of agree with the co-chair, Justin, as far as the statute seems really limiting on the executive. And it also seems relatively murky whether or not we're kind of approaching that correctly. So I don't know if you know if anyone's ever attempted to bring legal challenge to that or not through the chair.
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'm not aware of that. I would ask Director Fisher if, in his 30 years in the department, if he's aware of any of that?
Director Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Staff, for the record, Brian Fisher. No, as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been any legal challenge. So the funding into the disaster relief fund is, you know, appropriated through the regular appropriations process. And then the financing plans and all of the revisions that occur over the life of a disaster, if you will, above that $1 million threshold are approved by the mechanisms that were just addressed. So I don't think there's ever been a legal challenge to the way funding is appropriated to the DRF or how funding from the disaster relief fund is allocated to a specific disaster. Over.
Follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up. Rep Staff for the director.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Fisher. Appreciate that answer. So my other question is, I was doing some research on this the other day, and it kind of looked like there had been times where the legislature didn't take action on disaster and the executive basically just spins out of the disaster relief fund and then just asks for a supplemental appropriation. I don't know if that's ever happened, but that was my understanding through the chair.
Director Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Staff, to my knowledge, I'm not aware of that either. The adjustments to allocations to disasters through the financing plan process is outlined in statute is a pretty regular occurrence for every disaster that we have, whether it's a state or federal one. So I don't really recall a time where action wasn't taken. Okay. Over.
Thank you.
Okay. Slide 10 with a question from Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair. One quick follow-up. I was just sitting here thinking, if we have a disaster declaration that's for 30 days and it is not extended and there's no legal reason to extend it to spend money, Why would there need to be an ability from the legislature to extend a disaster?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the disaster declaration, let me go back here. So it's really this AS 2623-020G that outlines some of those other authorities that the governor has under a state declared disaster. As I mentioned, you know, being able to suspend provisions of regulations and utilizing different resources of state government that is limited to 30 days so that you wouldn't get into a perpetual situation where you're just suspending things. And at some point, it gets back to a normal process of state business. We're not suspending emergency or we're not suspending procurement, you know, and contracting regulations and, you know, fees, charging fees and doing those things. But the response and recovery efforts will continue past the 30 days.
Quick follow-up?
Follow-up. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair. So under our last disaster, how long did and they're pretty extensive authorities under this Section G. There's 11 of them, and they're very extensive on what the governor has authority to do, hence why I believe that we have a requirement the legislature gives authority for that to continue. In this last disaster that we had, did any of these items in 1 through 11, were they exercised beyond the 30-day period?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, they were not exercised. They were exercised after extension. So there was an extension past the 30 days that was done by concurrence, and then there was an extension done by resolution when legislature was in session. That was to be able to continue to provide some of those regulatory fee waivers for survivors who were replacing their lost documents through the state, as well as allowing for emergency contracting to help with immediate recovery and repairs that were needed.
Co-Chair Josephson, for clarification, can I get a clarification on what we mean by concurrence for the extension of the disaster?
Are you referring to the presiding officers writing the governor and saying, go ahead?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Yep.
All right, slide 10.
Okay, so this gets into the assistant state disaster assistance programs that Alaska has. They're modeled after FEMA's assistance programs. There's one for individual household assistance and one for public assistance. I know when we hear public assistance, that typically refers to individuals, but in this case, public assistance is to repair damaged public infrastructures. The state of Alaska is one of the only states in the nation to offer such a comprehensive and high-paying assistance program for survivors. We model it after FEMA's assistance so that we can, one, assure that survivors are getting the fullest amount of support they're eligible for, and two, that we don't duplicate any payments of benefits, and also to ensure we can collect reimbursement from FEMA to the fullest amount possible. Back to the state if a disaster becomes a federally declared disaster. The individual and family grant program has two primary categories of funding that can be issued. One for the repair or recovery for an individual or family's primary residence, and the second is to replace lost or damaged personal property, primary mode of transportation, or other covered eligible expenses that may include medical, dental, or funeral expenses that were incurred as a direct result of the disaster. You can see on the right-hand side that there is a process that we go through. Our programs are not intended to make people whole and are not a replacement for insurance. And the amount of the grants vary year to year. We pay half of what FEMA would pay through their individual assistance programs. Disaster assistance programs are outlined and governed by AS 2623-090. And in regulation under 6 AAC 94. Additionally, there's a grant program for temporary housing for those displaced during a disaster. This grant pays for housing expenses related to being displaced as a result from the disaster for up to 3 months for renters and 18 months for a homeowner whose primary residence was damaged or destroyed. Until a federal disaster is declared, these programs are paid 100% by the state through the Disaster Relief Fund. And if a federal disaster is declared, survivors must also apply for FEMA's individual assistance program separately and would be paid directly by FEMA for those eligible expenses. The state then pays that 25% of funds expended for IA back to FEMA.
Okay. Question from Rep. Jimmy and then Rep. Bynum.
Yes. So, how does the assistant account for this? Especially knowing that most of Alaskans don't have insurance, and just as you described, people getting assistance to replace, you know, their nets, their boats, things of that nature. Of course, we're not eligible for insurance out in rural. So, how would this account for it?
Thank you, through the chair, Rep. Jimmy. There is just the process of when you apply for the assistance. That is just one of the first things that we would go through to analyze what a survivor is eligible for, and those insurance things are taken into consideration when determining application eligibility.
Follow up.
Yes, follow up. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. So this is not funds to replace a house that's been lost, correct?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, correct. It is a limited amount of funding based on what FEMA's individual assistance program pays out. The state would do half of that benefit amount.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, Yeah, I'm really interested in this particular component because, as Rep. Jimmy had said, you know, there's lots of people that may not have the ability to have insurance for lost property, whether that property is a fixed asset like a home or boats or other things. And so I was just wondering if there was any circumstances in where the state and or federal government has stepped in to help restore lost property in the sense of a home. And if so, under what authority would that be done?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, are you asking, like, if we would completely repair a damaged home to 100%? I'm not quite sure what your question is.
Rep. Bynum, clarification.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Yeah, so I understand that here you were basically saying that based on the FEMA model that you could have restoration of some level of dollars to cover for temporary housing. And in your slide, it here says grant to assist with housing repair or replacement. So I'm assuming that means to move or do something else. And there's probably there's a limit on that. But under certain circumstances, you may have your home is completely destroyed and it was uninsurable, or it's not covered by insurance. And so I was wondering if there's any instances under disaster where the state has stepped in to help restore and or make whole those homeowners for loss of property.
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I don't believe that's the case, but I would ask Director Fisher to answer that question.
Director Fisher, did you hear the question from Representative Bynum?
For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, through the chair, Representative Bynum. On the state side, the answer to that is no. We don't have any programs above what Ms. LaFlamme talked about, our statutory cap, which is half of FEMA's for housing repair or replacement. For the record, this year, that amount on the state side is $22,400 per household. However, on the federal side, there have been a few instances where FEMA has invoked a program called Permanent Housing Construction, and that's Section 528 of the Stafford Act. And I think it's a great question because for the response to the Halong remnant, the state has asked FEMA to invoke that authority that the federal government has. We are pending an answer on whether they're going to invoke that. The Permanent Housing Construction Authority is granted by the federal government. They do have a myriad of options, including up to rebuilding a completely destroyed house using federal dollars.
Secretary Justice.
Yes,
Representative. If I could ask that the Director Fisher be able to provide to the committee that specifics of that program and the information, that'd be helpful.
Director, can you provide to my office, which I will forward, a question about the program you're discussing? Representative Ginny.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Just to follow along that lines and ask the same question, but for Murbach, given that answer, pending, has that provision been enacted for Murbach?
Director Fisher, as to Murbach.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, no, that authority was not invoked or granted for Typhoon Murbach. The last time it was used in Alaska was during the catastrophic flooding along the Yukon River in 2013. That predominantly was catastrophic in nature to the community of Galena in the middle of Yukon.
Follow up.
Follow Rep. Jimmy.
Director Fisher, do you know people are still waiting for that funding from Murbach?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, for the individual assistance program, I don't believe there are any outstanding claims through FEMA for the Murbach response for households.
I'm going to have to say that's not true. We have people, constituents, who say they are still waiting for funding from Murbach and still have not received it. So people are still waiting for the FEMA funding, not just in my district, but in neighboring districts. Did you know that?
Director.
And the chair, Representative Jimmy, I did not. We would have to follow up directly with FEMA.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Fisher, are any of the restrictions that we are talking about in statute in Alaska that we could broaden our statutes, or are they all governed by FEMA definitions and restrictions?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the real big restriction is the maximum amount of financial assistance that could be provided, and that is in state statute. I believe Ms. LaFlemme had that statute citation. I think it's 2623090. Outside of that are regulations in 6AAC94 generally mirror FEMA's requirements, which includes things on the slide where we cannot make a grant available until we deal with insurance or other governmental assistance like small business assistance or Small Business Administration loans. Some of that is waivable by the agency, but those regulations really aren't that restrictive. The main one is the maximum amount of financial assistance in statute.
One follow-up?
Yes, follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Mr. Fisher, do you know when we last changed the maximum amount in statute?
Director Fisher.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon. I want to say it was somewhere around 15 years ago. And what we did, there used to be a set number in that statute. It was, when I started here, it was $2,000 per household. We moved it, or the legislature moved that to $5,000. And I want to say it was about 15 years ago. The way the statute reads now is half of whatever FEMA can pay. And FEMA adjusts their maximum for the federal program on an annual basis at the start of every federal fiscal year in October. So ours raises, and they have a cost, a CPI adjustment calculation that they use for the federal maximum. So ours just steps up every year along with the federal maximum as that gets adjusted.
One follow-up?
Yes, Rep. Hannon.
So we could exceed 50% of FEMA in our statutes if we chose to. We could go to, say, 75% of FEMA.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, We could, the way the statute reads now, is not more than 50%, and then the total amount of assistance between the state program and the federal program cannot exceed the federal maximum. So we certainly could. However, the impact of that would be less federal assistance dollars for those disasters.
Okay. Thank you.
Rep. Bynum, then staff.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Really quick, I know our DEC folks, I don't believe, are still on the line, but when we talk about recovery issues, we have loss of property. Assuming that a member of the community had a complete loss of their property, is there assistance in any kind of environmental remediation, for example, let's say a spilled oil tank on that property, or is that up to the property owner?
Director or Ms. LaFlamme?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I'm not as familiar with environmental conservation. Director Fisher might have a better answer for that one.
Thank you. I think that...
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, it depends on the type and nature of disaster, but typically for cleanup and remediation of household hazardous waste, upright and instilled home heating oil tanks. When there is a state disaster declared, the DEC and their contractors can respond to assist with the cleanup from a public health perspective, and those costs would be reimbursed through the disaster, through disaster relief fund and through the declared disaster itself. Same thing with EPA if it's a federal disaster, working hand in hand with DEC.
Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Keeneman, do you have anything to add to that?
Thank you, Chair Josephson. For the record, Crystal Keeneman, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Environmental Conservation. Representative Bynum, to answer your question, Director Fisher did mention that those funds would be reimbursed. I do know that for Halong and our response for that we're working through, we are not holding any homeowners responsible for any of those spills. We are taking care of them. They will be paid whether they're out of the disaster fund or whether they're out of our response fund. We will ensure that the funds are there to clean up.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Is that the case for all disasters when it comes to contaminants or hazardous materials being spilled?
Representative Bynum, through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Fisher. So just to clarify the statute, I went and pulled it, and I want to make sure that we're talking about two separate things. The first thing is in the event that in subsection 1, it says when the president declares a major disaster, that's when we're limited by 42 USC 55174H for grants payable to individuals. So it sounds like that section, when the President of the United States authorizes a disaster, we're basically indexed to whatever that number is. As far as the 50% limitation, that is in the event that the President does not authorize the disaster and only the Governor authorizes disaster. And that's my reading of the statute. Can you clarify that for the record through the Chair?
Director Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Staff, you're referring to 2623090, and in Section B, subsection 2 of that statute, it states when the president does not declare a major disaster, but the governor does, the governor may make a grant of an amount not to exceed one half of the maximum established under 1, which is that 42 USC.
Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow-up, Rep. Stapp.
Yeah, through the chair to the director. Yeah, that's correct. And again, the clarification is when the president does not declare the disaster, and it's when the governor does. And that's correct because that's how I read the statute, through the chair.
Mr. Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's go to slide 11.
For the record, Angela LaFlamme. This slide shows the pyramid that FEMA uses for public assistance project eligibility that the state mirrors as well for public assistance. As I mentioned before, public assistance can fund the repair, restoration, reconstruction, or replacement of a public facility or infrastructure which is damaged or destroyed by a disaster. You can see on the bottom tier there of the pyramid that the eligible applicants. Certain private nonprofits may also receive assistance eligible. We call them PNPs, include educational, utility, emergency, medical, rehabilitation, and temporary or permanent custodial care facilities, and other PNP facilities that provide essential services of a governmental nature to the general public. PMPs that provide critical services, power, water, sewer, wastewater treatment, communications, emergency medical care may also apply directly to the state or FEMA for a disaster grant. We talked about the types of facilities. When an eligible applicant applies for assistance, we have a meeting with them that develops a scope to assess what damages took place, what assess needs, and put into place a plan of action. We do site inspections, formulate a project, and document the eligible facility, eligible work, and cost for fixing those damages. This creates a project worksheet that we use. They fall into two different types of categories. There's emergency work, and then there's the permanent work that would be a more long-term recovery. We follow this model, again, similar, so that we are, if a federal disaster declaration is received, we're able to capture as much of that reimbursement from the federal government as possible.
Okay. We're going to, Rep. Jenny, go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. So a lot of my private nonprofit power utilities, we're wearing a lot of hats out there, and they're struggling, and just trying to get through the paperwork was hard. Because more than one time, they had to work with each other, even through different villages, even just to save one generator. Could the state do more to facilitate these public assistance programs, given the unique nature of some of our rural entities, which may be one or two employees in a village who are already doing cleanup and response?
Maybe, is that a question for the deputy commissioner or okay? No. Okay, all right. Well, Ms. LaFlum.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Jimmy, we do have a disaster application, a disaster assistance program team that can work with our agencies and partners to help them through the process. We do understand that when you're responding to a disaster, paperwork's not necessarily the first thing that you're trying to get through. And so we do have folks on our staff and our team that can help through that process. It is, unfortunately, especially when it becomes a federally declared disaster, a very burdensome paperwork process to be able to be eligible for that reimbursement. There's not a lot we can do about that, but we do try to help as much as we can.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
So I appreciate everyone's work, but the federal system doesn't seem to be designed to work with these kind of entities, like out in rural or nobody's communicating to or reaching out to see if they do need help. Thank you.
Rep. Stapp, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Justin, through the chair to Ms. LaFlamme. So just on Representative Jimmy's point, I'm glad we have a disaster assistance team, but, you know, my experience has been not most people, like, don't really know, like, what the disaster assistance team, like, phone number is, and so do you actively reach out to those people out there, or do you just wait for them to maybe get internet again and figure out how to call you through the chair?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, we do send folks out into the impacted areas to be able to do outreach. We provide information for the people who are going house to house, doing damage assessments, making sure that everybody has that information. We provide all the information to as many of our volunteers and partner agencies that are responding so that everybody has that information to make sure that we reach as many people as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I got a question.
Yes, Representative Ballard.
I just wanted to follow up because I think there is some concern about a delay. It happens. Could you tell me, I actually think Mr. Fisher would probably know. May I, Chair?
Question thank for you. Director Fisher.
Director Fisher, is Eagle River still waiting on other entities, communities still waiting on funds from the natural disaster from 2018?
Director Fisher.
Through the chair, for the record, Brian Fisher, director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, to Representative Ballard. Yes, we are still receiving payments from FEMA, reimbursable projects for the earthquake, the 2018 November Cook Inlet earthquake. As a matter of fact, just Friday we received what FEMA calls a large project notification of approximately $2.3 million federal share project for a solid waste services facility for the municipality of Anchorage. But I think your question is great because it points to the fact that the recovery process and reimbursement process through the state and federal programs is not quick. The response is, and I think you saw that in October with the evacuations and sheltering operations we did, but the recovery for permanent repair projects is very extensive. And I can say some of the contributing factors to that length are really the federal government's processes. A lot of it has to do with all of the environmental reviews that have to happen for permanent repair or reconstruction work to happen. But the reimbursement and recovery process is not quick by any stretch of the fashion because of the process it takes for all the federal approvals for that funding to come back to the state or to our local applicants.
Thank you. And can I just do a quick follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you.
Rep.
Director Fisher, this might be tooting your own horn, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. Would you say in the last decade that you guys have had probably the best response to natural disasters or disasters in Alaska history in the last 10 years as far as, yeah.
This is your one chance.
There you go. Big,
you don't want to... lose this opportunity.
Through the chair, Representative Ballard, I think we're improving every single day. We do have programs unlike any other state in the nation. Very proud of that, and a lot of that is thanks to the support of the legislature for the funding that goes to the Disaster Relief Fund. The federal government continues to look at improving and expediting their processes, but that is a slow process dealing with the executive and the legislative at the federal level. But we are continuing to try to reduce the amount of time it is from disaster to close out, if you will, where all of the homes and all the buildings are repaired and recovered. So I think the team here continues to do a great job at trying to get that timeline closed with all of the complexities of recovering from a disaster. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Foster, do you want to ask a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Murbach and Halong, they taught us that we need to be able to respond quickly to disasters. And we do have 21 local emergency planning committees, LEPCs, throughout the state. In 2019, I believe, the state stopped funding these local emergency planning committees. And I've had folks reach out to me asking whether or not the state, after these recent disasters, would reconsider funding them. And, of course, one way to do that is through UGF. But I'm wondering, I wanted to get your thoughts. I don't know if there are any avenues in terms of trying to get some federal funds for that or FEMA funds. Wanted to get your thoughts or anyone's thoughts on that.
Who would like to speak to the LEPCs?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, Director Fisher, if there's any federal opportunities for LEPC, I think we would probably be utilizing those if there were, but I will let him speak to that.
Director Fisher.
through the chair to Co-Chair Foster. Thanks for the question. So I just wanted to point out, for one, that local emergency planning committees are just that. They're planning organizations. At this time, there is no federal funding available. We get very limited federal emergency management preparedness grant dollars that are already distributed throughout the state. LEPCs were originally formed and are a federal requirement under the EPA and the Community Right to Know Act. And since its inception, that has been an unfunded mandate for us to fund either at the state or local level. I know one jurisdiction in the state, the municipality of Anchorage, funds their own activities through a surcharge that they charge on hazardous material facilities, but most of our committee don't have that capability. So at this point, they are continuing to do limited planning work, but don't have any funding, and it doesn't look like there is going to be any federal funding available for that in the future.
Follow-up. Thank you. Off the top of your head, for some reason I'm thinking it was a couple $100,000 back in 2019. Just wanted to see what if it was millions or hundreds of thousands, if you recall, question number one. Number two, I wonder if you've got any thoughts, and maybe this is something that we could talk about more in depth later, but regarding trying to get some funding, like I said, you could do state general funds or possibly carving out some, fees that are currently out there or increasing fees. Those are some of the, options, but I just wanted to maybe touch base with you and find out if there are other ideas that you might have. And if you've got anything right now, that's great. And otherwise, I can maybe touch base with you later as well. So.
Director Fisher.
Through the chair to Co-Chair Foster, historically, the funding, before it was ended, the state general funding was $300,000 per year. And unfortunately, and I want to make sure the committee understands this, I think I've had lots of conversations this year and last year about this. It definitely seems like the conversation inside the Beltway with the federal government, Congress included, is less federal support for activities when it comes to emergency preparedness. And even potentially response and recovery. So unfortunately, the future doesn't look great right now in terms of any additional federal support. So we'd have to look inward, I think, moving forward for that kind of support.
Yes. And Representative Foster.
And sorry, my final comments were probably more directed toward looking inward, realizing that the federal side probably is maybe a little bit of a dead end. And so just looking for some ideas in terms of things that we could do in terms of some of the fees that we might be charging already or just working around that. So anyway, I'll touch base with you, but appreciate it. Thanks.
Ms. LaFlamme, a quick comment on slide 12, and then we have to wrap this up. I've got a bill hearing. I can entertain one question. I've got one of my own. Ms. LaFlamme on slide 12.
Absolutely. Thank you for the record, Angela LaFlamme. So we have talked about how we get to a federal declaration throughout this. Again, our programs are mirrored after the Federal Emergency Management Administration's programs so that this process can be as smooth as possible. We get to the joint damage assessment where we've exceeded the state's capacity to respond. We meet certain thresholds that FEMA has established for consideration for a federal declaration. And within 30 days of a disaster, the governor can request a federal disaster declaration to the president. And just to reiterate, we minimally those declaration agreements, when they are authorized, they are a 75% federal funding and 25% state funding.
Okay. I'm going to invite Representative Jimmy to ask a question, then you. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin. And my question is, are individuals still waiting for the 2018 earthquake damages?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, individual assistance payments are typically they are prioritized and are some of the first dollars out of the door. I would request that if you do know or are hearing of people that have not received payments or are having issues with receiving payments, that you would reach out. We would need to follow up directly with, you know, our individual assistance folks to look into each case specifically. But as far as I know, those individual assistance payments usually are out, you know, within the period of time, since that application period is only open for a certain period of time after a disaster declaration.
Follow up.
Because people are, well, I just wanted to ask that because people are still waiting from the MERBOC FEMA funds to still go out. One of the things I have to share is regarding one of my, when I went to go out for a funeral in Chafornik, a teen suicide, there was a constituent that I was going to visit. I was visiting as many people as I could, but he was still waiting for his MERBOC. And his house is so unstable. You can take a pop can and you can put it at one end of his house and let it go, and it'll sway back and forth. And it'll keep doing that. That's how out of his house structure is gone. So I think we need to find some way to keep the FEMA funds moving forward, if that makes sense. But I just felt like I had to share that story, that there's still so many people waiting for the MERBOC funds. Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. Maybe this question can't be answered while we sit here with the time that we have. I'm just really wondering what elements the division of responsibility between local government, state government, federal government, specifically when we're talking about trying to get reimbursement for cost. I know that from my experience dealing with local municipal governments and an emergency, that tracking how we spend money is very important, and the local government played an important role in trying to do that. In our most recent disaster in Halong, what agency is ultimately responsible for making sure that we are going to recover as much of the cost associated with that disaster?
Ms. LaFlamme.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, that is Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
Thank you.
My last question. Do you have a question? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Through the chair, Representative Jimmy had a good question earlier about the weather stations, and I had heard maybe DOT was online, so I thought maybe we could ask them about those. I'm interested in that question as well.
Yeah.
Sorry. Thank you.
Are we still joined by Mr. Pannone? Or Ms. Keith?
I am on the line for the record. This is Dom Pannone, Director of Program Management and Administration.
Okay, Representative Moore.
Hi, Mr. Pannone. I wanted to ask about the weather stations. Representative Jimmy brought that up earlier in the conversation, and we were just curious if those are all intact and working functionally throughout the state, or are there ones that are needing repair offline? Maybe you can give a quick answer for that for us, please.
Okay, I can say that DOT has road weather information systems in which we have a team that ensures those are online. We also work with the FAA on weather stations that they maintain. So I don't believe every single one of those is online, but I could also pass to the Deputy Commissioner, Catherine Keith, who's also available and can speak a little further on this.
Ms. Keith, if you're online, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yeah, hi, this is Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith. So Mr. Chair, the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Weather Service do maintain AWOS and ASOS stations for weather reporting for airports. We still have a high percentage that are not functioning. It's largely due to telecommunications and power quality leading to those weather stations. Department of Transportation is partnering with FAA wherever possible to get those repaired. And the Don Young Safety Initiative that recently went into law will certainly help with that, with upgrades and modernization to those systems. So we look forward to an improved weather reporting across the state.
Thank you. Mrs. Keith, I appreciate the answer.
Okay. I don't see any further questions. Anything further, D.C. Christensen, Special Assistant LaFlamme?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Angela LaFlamme, for the record. The last document that we had provided to the committee was a spreadsheet of open disasters that the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management are still managing. As of January 2026, there were 63 open disasters. Some reflect actual costs for what has been received or paid out. And some you can see where we have an existing financing plan. You'll see there's $1 million or whatever the current financing plan authorizes. And then pending any other questions on that, that is the rest of our presentation.
Okay, thank you so very much. That concludes our business for today, and our next House Finance Committee scheduled for tomorrow, March 3rd at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we'll hear three presentations from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The first will be their FY27 budget overview, and then we'll hear a presentation on the Alaska Marine Highway System, and that'll be followed by invited testimony. And so lastly, we'll hear a presentation on the Alaska Statewide Transportation Improvements Program, otherwise known as the STIP. So with that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:34 p.m. Thank you.